Well, hello to everyone, and welcome to another installment in the 2013 Teleclass Education Lecture Series. My name is Paul Weber, and on behalf of Professor Syed Tatar, the co-founder of this program, I am very pleased that you have joined us for the Teleclass Improving Healthcare Global Overview. I met a very impressive guy at a conference in South Africa last year, and after hearing that guy's presentations, I insisted that he give a teleclass lecture this year, and luckily, he eventually said yes. That intelligent and articulate fellow was, of course, Dr. Rashad Massoud, a physician and internist, and an internationally recognized leader in improving healthcare. As you can see on the title slide, he is a director with USAID. He is also a senior vice president at the Institute for Healthcare Improvement in Cambridge, Massachusetts. I don't have time to detail all of his healthcare improvement efforts around the globe. He has participated and led many of them. I will mention, though, that Dr. Massoud was a founding member and for many years chaired the Multi-Country Quality Management Program for healthcare organizations in the Middle East and North Africa. He has consulted for and collaborated with organizations like UNICEF, the World Bank, the World Health Organization. He speaks fluent Arabic and Russian, and luckily for us, he is also pretty darn good at English as well. So to present the teleclass, Improving Healthcare Global Overview, I am pleased to turn the floor over to Dr. Rashad Massoud. Rashad.
Paul, thank you very much, and this was very flattering. If you could see me, I'm blushing all over. thank you very much, Paul, and it's a real honor for me to have the opportunity to reach out to such a distinguished group like yourselves. I wish I were in the same room with you and I could do this in person, but I guess technology is now so advanced that we're able to do this over other media, and I look forward not only to sharing with you some of our experiences, but also to hearing from you if you have any comments and questions, and you can channel those through Paul and Weber Training. I would be very happy to respond to any questions that you have or hear any comments that you have. With that, if I may also thank Paul for the invitation to share this with you, and without further ado, move into the presentation itself. Let me just say a couple of words about a lot of what I will be describing today. A lot of it really comes from my current work. I work for a company called University Research Company based in Bethesda, Maryland, a professional services firm that works in the area of development. It's known for its work in the area of improving healthcare, making healthcare better. Through that work, I direct one of USAID's global vehicles, the USAID Healthcare Improvement Project, and more recently we've been awarded the follow-on. So these are contractual mechanisms that are rebid every 5 years. We've just received the follow-on to the improvement project that we renamed as the USAID Applying Science to Strengthen and Improve Systems, the acronym being ASSIST, which also is significant in itself, and that we don't do the work, we help countries become able to do the work, so we assist them. So that's what I do, and of course I'm also building on previous experiences that I've had, namely, as Paul mentioned, with the Institute for Healthcare Improvement and some of the other organizations with which I've worked and had the pleasure of interacting. If you would move to the next slide, which is titled USAID Applying Science to Strengthen and Improve Systems, you'll see a map. And on the map, what I'm showing, this is the follow-on, the new project. These are the countries that we are working in the new project. So These countries, the ones that are colored, are the ones that we currently have activities in. And as you can see from the colors, they denote different technical areas. So essentially, the work that we do addresses global health priorities, pretty much all of those that are set out by USAID. For those who don't know, these include maternal, neonatal, child health, family planning, reproductive health, HIV, AIDS, TB, malaria, other infectious diseases. They include caring for patients with chronic conditions. They include community health work. They include health workforce development, caring for orphans and vulnerable children, and whatever other AID work is, USAID required work there is. Most of it really dealing with how do we make health systems strong enough to deliver better outcomes. That's really what it focuses around. And how do we engage with health workers in strengthening the systems that they operate in? If you would go to the next slide, which is again a map entitled USAID Healthcare Improvement Project, because this is an overlap year, we still have work that is happening under the old project and a work that's transitioned into the new project. So these are the countries where we are working with money that has been allocated from the previous year and continues into this year. And again, you'll see that there's a number of them. And I won't stop. This is a transition year. Beyond this year, we will probably be only dealing with one project and one set of funding. If you would please go on to the next slide, which is entitled Contributions to Achieving the MDGs in Fiscal Year 13. As we're doing this work, which really comes from a variety of sources, it comes from the countries themselves, it comes from global mandates in Washington, D.C., we're also cognizant of the fact that all of this work is being done in with the purpose of a higher level goal that all of the development agencies such as USAID and others are interested in, which is achieving the Millennium Development Goals. So with that, one of the things we've also been doing is mapping how have we been, through different country activities of ours, contributing to the achievement of the Millennium Development Goals. And this particular one is talking about the HCI, the Healthcare Improvement Project activities this year and their contribution to the MDGs. So that's just an overview to give you a sense of where all of the information I'm going to be talking about comes from, or primarily where it comes from. I'd like to go on to the next issue that I'll be talking about, which is there's a lot of conversation about poor quality care, what is good quality care, and it really is a live and vibrant discussion in many circles. I'd like to talk a little bit about what is the issue of quality in healthcare as we see it today. If you would go to the next slide, which is the scorecard for the Millennium Development Goals. This comes from the World Health Organization. It's a few years old now, but we're pretty much, it's not very different today than when this snapshot was shown. Essentially, what we see are the different MDGs on the left-hand side, and we see the world divided into continents on the y-axis on the top. And there are three colors on it. Green color means either achieved or on track to achieving the MDG targets. Orange means potentially on track. And red means not on track. That is really not unlikely to achieve the MDGs. Now, as you can see, for most of the developing world, we're either not making sufficient progress on the MDGs, or we're probably, you know, deemed not to achieve them given what we're seeing in terms of progress. Now, this picture is not strange. It's not something that takes a lot of people by surprise, and I want to talk about that for a little bit. if you go on to the next slide, what is the problem? And the next slide is a quote from Margaret Chan, the director, the general of the World Health Organization. And in her words, she says, "The reality is straightforward. The power of existing interventions is not matched by the power of health systems to deliver them to those in greatest need in a comprehensive way and at an adequate scale." Now, that really sums up in a very eloquent way what is the issue in quality in healthcare. The issue is not because we don't have interventions that work. In fact, we have a lot of them. There is an abundance of known, evidence-based, simple, for the most part, high-impact interventions that can save lives, that can alleviate human suffering, that can really contribute to attaining the MDGs. It's not the lack of those interventions. It is the lack of their implementation for every patient who needs them every time they are needed. That is the issue in quality of healthcare, or the biggest issue that we are seeing today in the area of quality in healthcare. Now, if you hear a lot of the conversation going on, I think President of the World Bank recently, last Tuesday, gave a Tuesday before gave a speech at GW, George Washington University, where he really talked about delivery, the science of delivery, as being the key thing that we need to address. The science of delivery, some people call it implementation science, some people call it improvement science. It doesn't matter what it is. What we're talking about is we know what works. We have a lot of known interventions that can really save lives. What we don't have is the ability to use those interventions in order to make things happen for every patient, every time they are needed. And that is the big issue in quality of healthcare today. Is this an issue only in developing country contexts? In reality, you know, one would think it is. But let me, if I can ask you to look at the next slide, which is now 10 years old, but I will show that this picture has changed, but not in terms of the principle of what I'm trying to explain. One of the largest studies about quality of healthcare was conducted by Beth McGlynn of the RAND Corporation. It was published in the New England Journal in 2003. She looked at 400 indicators across a number of conditions, both acute and chronic, reviewed several thousand patient records. And the conclusion of her study essentially came down to the defect rate in technical quality. We're not talking about amenities, we're not talking about waiting times, we're talking about technical quality of healthcare in the U.S. This is a U.S.-based study, was 45%. Essentially what she's saying is half of the patients get half the care half the time. That's what that study is. And it's very telling. Again, the multiple studies have shown that even in the most developed and most sophisticated of contexts, the number of interventions that we know to work and can really save lives, that can alleviate suffering, that are not being put into practice in a reliable way so that every patient who needs them can benefit from them, is quite astounding. And this is an issue in quality in healthcare, a big issue here in the U.S., in many of the developed countries, and of course it's the same issue that we see in developing countries. It looks a little bit different. The symptoms can be slightly different. We're seeing maternal deaths in developing countries. We're seeing neonatal deaths, but we're also seeing adult deaths in the U.S. for the same reason. So the big, if asked what is the big issue in quality of healthcare, I'd say it's the lack of implementation in a reliable fashion. It's not that we don't implement them. We do implement them, but not for every patient every time they are needed. It's we implement them for some of the patients some of the time that they are needed, but not for every single one of them every single time they're needed. And that's what the big issue is. And it's across the board. It's developing countries, it's developed countries, it's everywhere. I want to go on to the next slide, which is titled Hospital Death Rate. If you would go on to that one and take a look at it. This one needs a little bit of explanation. On the y-axis is a rate that was, this work comes from Sir Brian Jarman, former president of the British Medical Association, who is currently working in, and he did this work at Imperial College in London. He looked at mortality as an indicator of quality. Of course, to look at that, you know, you have so many confounders that affect mortality. So what he did was he said, well, can I standardize for all of these confounders? I think he standardized for something like 280-some confounders that affect mortality rate and came up with a measure that he called hospital standardized mortality rate. So that measure basically, and he said this, he had completed this work in 2004. He said, well, the 2004 standard will be 100. So basically, if you take an entity, a facility, and their HSMR, hospital standardized mortality rate, is at 100, that means the number of deaths, actual deaths in that hospital, were equivalent to those, to the number that were expected in that hospital, given all the factors that can influence mortality. And with that index, the rate in the, that he developed, you could actually compare amongst hospitals. Now, if you look at the graph that we have, each dot is a hospital, and these are hospitals in the U.S. And what he's looking at is, on, you know, he's got the 100 line where most of them are, but then if you look around that, you're going to find some that have less than 100, which means that they actually had fewer deaths than expected, given everything that we would that can affect mortality, and others had higher deaths than expected, and it wasn't a small variation. You could see that there's a fourfold variation in the standardized mortality rate. Now, that is very concerning. That means for the same entity, you have four times as much chances of dying depending on where you go. If you look at the x-axis, he did the same thing for cost and basically standardized the cost. And there, you can see a fivefold difference. Now, what is that telling us about quality of care? It's telling us a lot. It's saying that you can have four times as many chances of dying depending on where you go. It's also telling us you can pay five times as much for the same thing depending on where you go. And that's standardizing for different costs of living, for inflation rates, for, you know, cities, some cities being more expensive. All of that is factored in for. And if you look at the graph, there's no correlation. It's a scatter plot. There is no relationship between cost and quality. It's not like if you pay more, you get better quality of care. There is no such relationship on the graph. Of course, let me ask you the question that I usually ask in a room like this. Would you rather be in the top upper quadrant or the lower bottom quadrant? And I think the answer is, yeah, everybody wants to be in the lower bottom quadrant. I'm going to pay one-fifth to have one-quarter the chance of dying from the same entity, from the same disease entity, depending on where I go. Now, this does not surprise us. Many of you may have already read Crossing the Quality Chasm, and I want to, if you go on to the next slide, where it describes the issue of quality in healthcare, and there's I like to say that the way they describe it is between the care that we can have and the care that we have is not only a gap but a chasm, and it comes from poor systems. The same thing that Margaret Chan is saying, not because people are bad or people don't want to perform or they don't perform. it really is a systems issue that is leading to much of what we're seeing in the area of healthcare quality. I'll pause for a moment and just give you a chance to take that in and go on to the next part of the presentation. So if I can go on to the next part, which in the next slide, what results are we seeing? I've painted a gloomy picture that we know a lot of things at work, however, they're not being implemented reliably for every patient every time they're needed, and that this is primarily the big issue that we have in quality of care. However, we're also seeing some terrific results. I mean, let me just share some. I'm starting with one from one of the hospitals in the U.S. This is the work that then led to the 100,000 Lives campaign plank on acute myocardial infarction bundle. Basically, things that are known to work. When I was in clinical practice over 20 years ago, we knew all of these elements. However, was there reliable implementation of all of these elements for every patient every time? Definitely not. The elements, if any of you are in this area, are very quite straightforward and known to pretty much everybody. They're aspirin on arrival and discharge, beta blocker on arrival and discharge, ACE inhibitors if there's heart failure, timely thrombolytic therapy, and smoking cessation counseling. Through the implementation of the seven elements of the AMI bundle, mortality rate has dropped to 25% from acute myocardial infarction, one of the biggest causes of death in adults and men in all around the world, not just developed countries. If you go on to the next slide, now this is an updated slide, the work of Sir Brian Jarman again. This is 2008 data. And the reason I'm sharing this with you is to show you that there is progress. There's a lot of work that's happening. First of all, you'll see that the number of hospitals have increased. Many more hospitals have decided to join. This is good work. Why wouldn't they? So they've joined, and there's a lot more data available today. The next thing is that you'll see that the majority of hospitals have actually dropped from the 100, and they're somewhere, you know, just below 80, if you look at the, or around the 80%. Now, over the year in, year out, one of the things we've found is that actually there is a 3-point drop year in, year out, just because of the normal progress that is happening in the medical field, which is good to know. However, you find the pattern is still not a correlation between quality and cost, and there's still a 4-4 variation that still exists. So it's not like, you know, it's become tighter. It still hasn't become tighter. And, of course, with cost, we're dealing with the same issue. So there is progress, yet insufficient progress, visibly on follow-up 4 years later. The next slide, titled Uganda, I'm sharing this with you because now this is a whole other area of the world, and this specifically is about incorporating nutrition into the everyday care that is provided in the health centers for patients with HIV. You'll notice on this slide that what they tried to do was basically to determine, assess whether the AIDS patient they have is needs what's called food by prescription, supplemental dietary prescriptions, so that because a lot of them lose weight and a lot of them can't keep up. So one of the ways to do that is by measurement of the arm circumference. And as with all sort of new interventions, the first thing one does is they develop a job aid and they train people in the materials, and that's exactly what happened. So all the staff, if you look at the beginning of the graph, nobody was getting their arm circumference measured. This was introduced as a new thing. Everybody was trained, and the next week after that, these are weeks, the next week everybody got their arm circumference measured. Great. Look at the week after, it drops to less than 70%. The week after that, it drops to 20%. And as they saw this dropping, not the week after that, six weeks later, it dropped to 20%. Now, as they were looking at that, that's when they asked us to intervene. And of course, you know, there's a thing that we say more often than we'd like, which is training is a necessary but insufficient way of improving care. It's important for people to know, but the fact that they know doesn't mean that they implement, and doesn't mean that they implement reliably for every patient every time. This is a great example of that. So we talked about, okay, how is the process designed? How is this happening? Well, the way it was designed at the beginning is they trained the physicians to do this. Now, of course, we're dealing with AIDS clinics that are very heavily burdened and overburdened in Uganda. The physicians really don't have the time. The week after the training, you know, because this is new, it's a fancy thing, and they want to do it, and, you know, they'll put an extra effort of some sort, and they'll try and get it done, and they did. But then, of course, it'll deteriorate just like everything else does. Anybody who's worked in these contexts can have a good understanding of why, how life happens in most of these places. And this is not limited to Uganda or less developed contexts. I think it's a worldwide phenomenon. So then we worked on process redesign, so got the team together, let's talk about this, let's see how we can set it up. And they decided that they would assign one of the staff specifically for that. And as they did that, you can see that, you know, it started to go up 70-80%. And then it sort of plateaued at the 70-60% mark. So, you know, as we say, an improvement perfectly designed to achieve the results it achieves. So assigning one person in the clinic to do this achieves a 60-70% improvement rate. Why only 60-70%? Because it's one person, because that person has other needs. That person may need to take a break, may need to go somewhere, that person gets called, something else, patients skip the line. The other thing is, when you assign a patient, one person, what happens at that point is that, and you've got so many patients, some patients will say, well, I don't want this, I just want to get my, you know, my treatment and go. So they'll skip the line deliberately. And, of course, they'll explain to the doctor that I really cannot wait, I've got other things, for, you know, etc. And so with that, essentially what happened was lines started to grow, and the physicians would then just say, okay, like, next time make sure you do it, and of course it starts to slip, and you get the level of performance that you get. Again, the team met it over and over, and they sort of discussed it, and they decided to use a novel thing that they have. In Uganda, and given the AIDS epidemic, they have a number of patients who are doing very well, who actually have some spare time, who can, who volunteer on a regular basis, and they actually do that because of their willingness to help other patients, since they're doing well. They call them expert patients. They know so much about their disease and how to manage it, and they've become, you know, models that people are using. So they decided to involve the expert patients in this, and of course there's a number of them, and you can see that with that, it starts to go up, and it starts to reach 90%, and so given that change. Will it ever be 100%? We'd hope so, but, you know, every system is perfectly designed to achieve exactly the results it achieves. I think if doctors started to turn down patients to say to them, oh, you haven't had it done, you need to go back and get it done, we may get to the 100%, but that would take another design feature to get it there. The key thing, the key message I'm sending from this is, you can see that simply telling people what to do, simply issuing instructions, simply giving job aid, simply giving training to people doesn't necessarily make it happen. It needs to be built into the design of the everyday work for that all to come together in a good way and to get the results that we want. And it's not one change. It's a series of iterative changes that can get us to the place that we want. And processes need to be monitored for a while until they stabilize at the level of performance we want. Let me go on to the next example. This is the active management of the third stage of labor in Niger. This is one of the simple high-impact interventions that can really save lives. The intervention itself, as they defined it in Niger, consists of three elements. some places have defined it slightly differently, but they all revolve around the same thing. The first one is giving a drug called oxytocin at the third stage of labor when the right shoulder of the baby is delivered. And that, what that drug does is that it actually contracts the uterus, and if you know how the uterus is structured, it's essentially a network of muscles in different directions, and the blood vessels flow between them. So if it contracts, it actually compresses the blood vessels and stops the bleeding, and if it relaxes too much, that's when you get the bleeding, and after delivery, the chances that the muscles will be so tired that they'll relax is much higher. Therefore, giving them a drug that contracts them will help stop that bleeding. That's number one. The number two one is external uterine massage, so stimulating the muscle by actually massaging it. And the third intervention, which is critical, is also the what's called the controlled cord traction, which is to try and deliver the placenta as soon as possible after the baby is born so that it doesn't get stuck there, and that also helps the uterus to contract. The blue line on the graph shows compliance with all or nothing compliance with the active management of the third stage of labor. And as you can see, it was pretty much rarely done, and then it shoots up. Now let me talk about rarely done. One of the properties, I usually ask these, and a lot of people in the room who have worked in the area of OBGYN usually guess the story right away. I don't have that opportunity here, I'll just tell the story as it is. Oxytocin as a drug is thermally unstable, which means if you're not keeping it in refrigerated, it'll disintegrate, and it's not a good drug to give if it starts to go bad. So what happens is it's kept in a fridge. In most of the settings that we're dealing with in developing countries, there's usually only one fridge. It's usually in the pharmacy. And, of course, the pharmacy has all the drugs and supplies in it. So at night, it's, you know, locked, and the pharmacist has the key. And they don't usually leave it lying around in the health center. So given that most of the deliveries tend to happen at night, most of the time what will happen is this, that you have a delivery and you know that you want to give the oxytocin, but the pharmacist isn't there. On the rare occasion when the delivery is during the day and the pharmacist is available, doesn't have a long queue to deal with, you know, patients trying to get their drugs, you can actually manage to get some oxytocin. You can see a blip there where some patients did get it. So when the team got together, they started to think, well, how can we change this? How can we actually make sure that the simple high-impact intervention is being implemented for every patient every time? Well, one idea that came through was the following, that, well, what if, you know, we had fridges? Well, we can't buy fridges. That doesn't work. What if we did this? What if? Then they realized that we have to go to simple solutions, and these are health workers who understand their settings intricately. So some of them said, well, wait a minute, why can't we buy the coolers that people use, and we can put, you know, coolers in at night? And that would work. It's also not very hot at night. Therefore, the coolers actually work well. So some of them started to implement that. Others said, oh, all we need are ice packs. And, you know, when I get a woman who's delivering, I can just pre-fill the syringe, put it on an ice pack, and take it in with me. And all of a sudden, all you need is somebody to think that way, start to test it, they figure it out, and the rest of them start to do it, and you can see a very large increase. Now, compliance with the evidence-based intervention is very high, all of a sudden shoots right up, and the red line is postpartum hemorrhage, the number one cause of death during childbirth. So those are saved lives, essentially. Half of them would have actually been lost during delivery or shortly after delivery. And this is for pretty much most of the health centers in the country where a third of the deliveries happen. So this is a story that I like to tell because it's very visible. It's not rocket science. It's simple interventions. It's people who know their health care settings that can make these things happen. Let me go on to the next slide. You'll see the next slide is a very similar one. It's, again, the same intervention, but this time this intervention is in Mali, And guess who, a neighboring country, and guess who, which team helped the Malians do that? This was the Niger team who did the first work, who went and worked with their colleagues in Mali, and these are the results that they got. Again, amazing work, and it doesn't take somebody from our project in the U.S. to go and work with them. These are our colleagues in Niger who had this terrific one of, an amazing accomplishment by working and sharing their experiences and their know-how with their colleagues in Mali. I'm going to run through a number of things like these just to show you that although I painted a gloomy picture at the beginning, there's a lot of light at the end of the tunnel. The next one is case fatality for neonates from sepsis in four hospitals in Nicaragua. And again, I'm choosing different countries just to show you that in different technical areas, in different countries around the world, these things can happen. And as you can see, a significant drop. I won't stop to tell the whole story here. That's not my purpose, but it's to show you that things like these can really be done. They can be done very successfully. Next one is from Kenya. This is antenatal care, 21 facilities, and you can see several parameters there where they started all at a low level. These are pregnant women who are whose blood pressure gets measured, whose hemoglobin gets measured. They receive their 3 months iron supply and their blood pressure. Their blood group, is known in case they need a blood transfusion during delivery. So these are, results from Kenya. Again, I'm back to Uganda here with newborn resuscitation, and as you can see, starts at a low level with simple high-impact interventions, redesigning care delivery in ways that allow us to make these things happen. The changes are noted and the indicators are noted. As you can see, the significant progress in resuscitating neonates in Uganda. This is family planning uptake in Afghanistan. These are Kabul hospitals, five hospitals in Kabul. The next one is a very interesting one. This is where we looked at patients who are on antiretroviral therapy, who are being identified by community, by village health teams on their own, versus when we worked with the village health teams in a systematic approach, applying improvement methods at the community level, really trying to figure out, not just have their village health workers do their own thing on their own as they usually do, but really put them in a system where they interact with the health facilities, where they interact with the community leaders and other non-governmental organizations in the place. And you can see, again, number of interventions there that can allow you to find more of these patients and engage them in their care. Again, Uganda, self-management support for patients with HIV. Again, these are patients who are now being much more engaged in their work and actually self-managing their illness. The next one is a very interesting one. The next one is a framework. We started to think about, what constitutes good care for patients on antiretroviral therapy, and we applied a chronic care model to redesign care delivery systems along, some of you may be familiar with Ed Wagner's chronic care model. This is work that we did in Uganda, five sites, and the lines here, the top line represents the number of patients who are HIV, number of HIV patients who require antiretroviral therapy. And as you can see, over time, the numbers increase because patients will convert to requiring ARVs over time. The line immediately underneath that is a requirement, a reporting requirement for PEPFAR, the presidential initiative, and that's pretty much in most countries. And that line is patients ever started. The problem with ever started is that we start a patient on treatment, but there's a lot of patients who drop out of treatment. Now, Ever Started also includes anyone who relocates, anyone who passes away, etc. The line immediately underneath that is the number of patients, subtracts out numbers of patients who have passed away or numbers of patients who have relocated and legitimately are receiving care elsewhere. Now, you can see that the first gap in care is the coverage gap, the difference between those who need treatment and those who get it. And then the next line down is the orange line, and that is the difference between the yellow line, those that were started but did not pass away or did not legitimately transfer out, and those who come back on a regular basis. And that is what's called the retention gap, retaining patients who are started on treatment on an ongoing basis. And then the green line are of those who are retained, how many, what proportions are doing well. And as you can see, in working on this, the gaps still remain, but they're much reduced. So started with a coverage gap of 44, and at this point we are, or at last point on this graph, it's 16%, started with a retention gap of 49, now it's 24%, and from 53 to 15 wellness gap. Again, work that's very much in progress, and a framework for improving care for patients on antiretroviral therapy. The last graph that I want to show is a graph that comes from work that we did way back in the Russian Federation, in the work we did in 98 in improving care for neonates, tackling hyaline membrane disease, neonatal respiratory distress syndrome. The first 2 years were a demonstration phase, and on the graph you see the the red line is the infant mortality rate, the dotted green line is the neonatal mortality rate, and the blue line dotted underneath that is the early neonatal mortality rate, which is the first week of life. And as you can see in the demonstration phase, we had some great progress, which was then taken and spread from the five hospitals, demonstration hospitals, to all 42 that covered the whole of the area that we worked in, which is Tver Oblast. In 2002, we ended our project there. We left. I happened to visit 6 years later in 2009, or 7 years later in 2009. And when I went back, it was very interesting for me to visit colleagues and friends, and I ended up at the Department of Health, where they shared with me the same draft that I was working with them on years ago. And what they showed here is that they're twice as good as we had left them, continuing to work on improvement. And this is a real key point, that when we're working on improvement, we not only want to make healthcare better, we want to create the capability to continually improve. And this is a prime example of institutionalization of improvement as a means of doing work on an ongoing basis. The next few slides are really about the about a study that we conducted on looking at 27 collaborative improvement projects. We wanted to see the improvement in quality of care, how quickly they were achieved, and how long were the gains maintained for. So there were several topic areas, if you go to the next slide, across multiple countries, and we looked at 135 time series charts like the ones I just shared with you. And so this becomes sort of a more like high-level overview of improvement results, and what it shows is that 88% of the teams were able to reach 80% compliance with their objectives, improvement objectives, 80% or more, and three-quarters of them were able to achieve 90% compliance or more. For those that started at less than 50% compliance, it took them just over a year, and for those that started at more than 50% compliance, it only took 6 months, and 80% compliance was maintained for over a year out of a 19-month period of observation. Let me now go on to a definition of quality of care that I like to talk about, and I'd like to do that using a quick story. This is a story about a woman who basically had was delivering in a developing country setting. She was being delivered at home by the traditional birth attendant, who had been the traditional birth attendant was part of an improvement effort. And as part of that, she was they had developed a standard operating procedure that if the placenta is not delivered within half an hour of the delivery of the baby, that is a danger sign, and the woman needs to be transferred to a health center that can deal with that. Of course, the TBA knew which health center to deal with, so what she did was she sent the brother of that woman to inform the health center. So he went out, flagged down a car that took him to the health center. He reported what the TBA said to him. They put him in an ambulance and said, take us to your home. He showed them where the home is. They took her back to the health center. As soon as they sent him in the ambulance, they called the emergency team to be ready for this. And on arrival, she was right away being taken care of. She was entered for immediate treatment, which is basically manual removal of the placenta. And about an hour later and 2 hours after the baby's birth, that mother was in the bed and nursing her infant. Now, this is a real story. This my predecessor, Dave Nicholas, actually told that story. And if you would go on to the next slide, when he was telling this story, he said something that I noted and we've used as a definition of how we understand quality of care. Quality of care, as he said it, is what happens at all points of service along the continuum of care, and high quality care is a function of the system's ability to produce care that will address the client's health issues in an effective, responsive, and respectful manner. And I think it really, captures how we see quality of care and how what we work to do. So recognizing danger, deciding to evacuate her to the health center, the transport, which was sort of very sort of locally developed, the way they received her at the health center, mobilized emergency care, the good technical care they gave, the good interpersonal communication concern, the good result and the follow-up, these are all the issues that we would want to see in a quality care system, and they happened all along the continuum of care that was needed for this particular patient. It really boils down to doing the right thing at the right time, and of course the devil is in the details. So I wanted to use that story and just home us in on how the Institute of Medicine in the U.S. defines a quality care system. It's a system that's safe, that does not harm its patients, that's effective, that gives the best medicine that we know. It's centered around the patient's needs, it's timely in its delivery, it does not waste, and it's for everybody. In the last few minutes that I have, I'd like to move on to a little bit of an overview of the science of improvement as we know it today. And in doing that, I'd like to also point out that there's a lot of ways in which, if you would go on to the next slide, which has a title, Different Ways by Which Quality of Care Can Become Better, there is the gradual accumulation of knowledge and experience. I mean, it happens over time. It's something that we live every day, and Sir Brian Jarman's graph shows that there is that knowledge. There is progress. So that alone improves quality of care. However, we also have some scientific advances. We discover things. We do experiments that allow us to find new ways of treatment, new diagnostics, etc., which all contribute to improving quality of care. Sometimes we by trial and error, we test something and it works, and that's also a way of doing it. Sometimes we improve care by coincidence. We didn't intend to, but we find out that, something we did actually was good. However, there is also a systematic, methodological way of going about improving care, and this is what I want to talk about here, that acknowledging everything else, we can still, and whether those are present or absent, we can still make quality of care better by essentially going through a few key frameworks that allow us to make healthcare better. Let me go on to those very quickly. The first one is integrating content and organization of care. And this goes back to the idea that there are high-impact interventions that can save lives, and what we need to do is to reliably implement them for every patient every time. And to do that, we need to go into the next slide, improvement principles and frameworks. Every system is perfectly designed to achieve exactly the results it achieves. That is, if we continue to do what we're doing, we will continue to get the results that we're getting. And if we want different results, we have to do something different, and we have to see whether that different thing actually yielded a better result or not. So underlying improvement as we know it today is looking at the work that we do in healthcare delivery in terms of processes and systems, and engaging the people who are working on an everyday basis in these processes and systems in the redesign of their work. One, because they can make things happen, they know how to make them happen, and more importantly, because if they do that, then they will develop ownership of their accomplishments, and what they'll then do is retain them, and this becomes a new way of work. As we do that, we need to be very focused on the fact that we do this because there's a patient that needs it. If there wasn't a patient, we wouldn't be needing that. Therefore, to be very customer and patient-focused is key to doing this and being successful at it. And, of course, we introduce all of these changes because we think they'll make things better. We have to actually show that they make things better. Therefore, this iterative testing and continual measurement, the way I showed you with these charts, on a facility level, I was showing you aggregates for multiple facilities, but we have them at every facility, and they monitor and see, did this change really make an improvement or not? And if it did, then can we institute it? And if it didn't, can we change it or modify it in a way to make it work? And if not, should we be taking it out? And a lot of times that's what we do. Now, there's another principle that I've added, which I call shared learning. In the past, when I first started, we used to work with individual teams, and some of them made great progress, others didn't, some got discouraged, and it took a long time. We have found over time that when you put multiple teams together and you put them through a structured process by which they learn together and share experiences as they're testing different changes, we get far better results. This has become a principle by which we organize our work. We can go on to the next slide, and this is what's called the Plan, Do, Study, Act cycle, the cycle for learning and improvement. Essentially, underlying improvement is change, and there's a systematic way by which we test different changes to see if they've yielded improvement or not. And then, of course, just the idea that it's not just one test, and it's not just testing one type of thing. So for the postpartum hemorrhage reduction, this is illustrative just to give the idea that you not only need to have the supply chain, the drugs available, you need to maintain the cold chain, you need to have skilled midwives, but also the pre-filled syringes and the coolers, etc. And you're testing multiple little changes or big changes as you go along and ramping them up, all of which lead together to the improvements that we see. I know we're coming up against time, so I'm going through this relatively quickly. It is an overview. And then the next thing I want to talk about is that this comes from the Institute of Medicine, Crossing the Quality Chasm, the four-tier health system design. If you look at the top one, patient community, that's really where improvement happens. To the extent possible, what we want to do is to make sure that we design and we implement care that is safe, that's effective, patient-centered, along the IOM aims. This is the patient's experience with care. This is where the provider sees the patient. This is where it all happens. To do that, we need to look at the system, the microsystem in which it's embedded. That's the clinic, the facility, the unit in the big hospital, etc., where we need to make sure that we are designing processes that are conducive to delivering this great care to the patient. That's where, you know, you sort of say, well, you know, the oxytocin on the prefilled in the prefilled syringe on an ice pack type of redesign. And then you look at the organizational context as a whole, which basically is looking at, do you have the human resources to do that, Do you have the leadership, the finances, etc.? And then, of course, there are the environmental context issues that are very relevant to this as well. And this is where we look at design concepts such as issues related to regulation of care, the financing of care, and others that affect that. So that whole system, all needing to be conducive to the delivery of the right sort of care at the front line, where the patient sees the or interacts with the healthcare system. And last but not least, I want to leave you with a thought. If you would go on to the final slide, and I don't think I need to say anything there. If we don't appeal to people's not only minds but also hearts, I don't think we can get this. And with that, I'll stop. I think we're a few minutes away from the end of the session, and I'll hand over back to Paul.
Thank you very much, Dr. Massoud. Thank you. The photograph you showed right at the end there is classic, and it reminds me of something that happened in my neighborhood where the people who were scheduled to paint the road got to their job before the people who were supposed to pave it, and so it got painted, and then it got paved. And the people who were painting didn't notice, or I guess didn't care, that they were painting over an already painted road. They just went ahead and did it, and then the paving people came along and paved it, and it stayed that way for 2 years before somebody had the budget to repaint it again. But I thank you for pointing out several times that it really is a multimodal strategy. And this comes up again and again and again in teleclasses and in the conference lectures, that there's no one thing, no silver bullet that will improve. It's a whole bunch of little things and projects that you stay with while they are working, and when they stop working or if they're obviously not working, then you change them or abandon them. And on the very last slide, I'd like to acknowledge our patron sponsors, Virox Technologies and the World Health Organization. They are very good to us, and I would like to thank them especially for their time. Thanks to all of you for joining us today on what I think has been a fascinating ride through some of the challenges and successes that our speaker has had. And Rashad, thank you very much. I have enjoyed this very much, and I know that the online recording of it, once it is posted to the website in the next half hour or so, will be very popular. Sir, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure, and I hope that you enjoyed it. And again, if you have any questions, please don't hesitate through Weber Training.
Thank you. That's something that I should have mentioned as well. My email address is on the title slide and at the bottom of each of the pages of the handouts. So if you have a question or a comment for our speaker, please send it to me, and I will forward it to him, and he is very good at getting back to email. Again, thank you to all, and we will talk to you again very soon. Goodbye.